From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. You know that pride you feel when your dog responds to your command? Or how your cat always seems to know when you're a little down in the dumps? Animal intelligence fascinates us as pet owners, and biologists have studied it for years. But primatologist Frans de Waal says asking if animals are as smart as we are is really the wrong question. Frans de Waal is the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. He's also a professor of psychology at Emory University. I spoke with him in May about his new book called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And I began the conversation by asking him if scientists have been judging animals' intelligence based on whether they can do human tasks.
Yeah, we are very focused, of course, on language and reading and writing and technology. And we are very strong in that. And so we have tried to judge animals on those terms. And that works okay with, let's say, a chimpanzee who is very similar to us and has very similar skills. But there are species, you know, like, let's say, the octopus or the elephant or certain birds that are very smart but are very different from us and have a very different lifestyle. And why would we make that comparison? Is that really interesting to know, are you smarter than an octopus? Well, in your environment, with what you daily do, you are obviously very smart. But in the octopus's environment, who knows how you would be faring? We don't know.
And what a continuing theme throughout the book is this idea of crafting a useful experiment. One of the questions we've often asked is how well do animals use tools? That's been a measure of intelligence in the past. But you talk about one in which they didn't take into account the animal's biology, the structure of the animal's body when they were crafting the experiment. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so for example, with the elephant, they tested elephants on mirrors to see if they recognize themselves in mirrors, but they used a very small mirror, and an elephant probably only sees a whole lot of gray moving around in a small mirror. And they tested tool use in elephants by giving them a stick and putting food outside of their cage and see what they would do. And any primate will pick up the stick and get the food closer and then eat it, of course. But the elephant was not doing anything. And they had concluded that means elephants are not tool users. But elephants have a trunk, and the trunk is not just a grasping organ, but is also a smelling organ. And it turns out the elephant doesn't want to close off that organ when he reaches for food. And so when they gave elephants boxes to stand on, even boxes that were far away that he had to bring all the way from another part of the enclosure to the place where they had hung some food very high, he would do that. And so he was able to use tools, but not the way we wanted them, so to speak. And that's always a problem with testing of animals. If you don't find something, what does that mean? Does that mean that it lacks a capacity, or does it mean that we did not do the right test on them?
So there's also a really fascinating section on testing of mice, and mice are such common lab animals. They were testing to see if mice could conceal the fact that they were in pain. How did that experiment work?
Well, there's several pain experiments. One on mice was on what we call empathy. So there's now increasingly studies on rodents and empathy. And the mouse study was to see if they exhibited pain and if that stimulated the pain sensitivity of other mice. So that was what they call pain contagion. And recently at Emory, we did a study on voles. Voles are also little rodents. And we did a neuroscience study on empathy and found that the neural circuitry, basically, the way empathy works in the rodent is exactly the same it works in the human. And so this is a very old system that you also have in your average dog. Your dog is empathic. Your dog responds to your emotions. And that's actually why we have dogs and cats in the house rather than snakes and lizards usually, because mammals have that capacity and we like that in them.
So then there was another point at which scientists threw a t-shirt that smelled of humans into the cage with the mice, and they were really afraid. And I wondered, does that mean that every experiment related to mice is in some way possibly flawed because there are humans present?
Ah, well, what they found actually is that mice perform better with female experimenters than male experimenters. And that mice are apparently a little bit stressed if they smell that there's a man around. And that may be true for other animals as well. We know it now for mice. Who knows? It may be true for other animals. And so that means that if you have experimenters of two genders, you have to watch which gender is doing the testing. And so this all relates to methodology. We in science, of course, the scientists, we are very keen on good methodology, and we need to pay attention to that. But people don't always realize that these small details, because it seems like a small detail, matter a lot for the animals.
And it also, in terms of methodology, makes it difficult to test these things in a lab, right? As opposed to going out into the field and watching gorillas in their own natural habitat, which is something that's been discussed long before. It makes it difficult to create a lab experiment that really shows us the natural behavior of an animal.
Yeah, that's why it's very important to always combine the two. So I do, of course, my experiments, I do them in Lawrenceville here at the Yerkes Field Station. And those are captive chimpanzees that live outdoors, but we call them indoors for the experiment, basically. That's how it works. But we always need to combine that knowledge with what we know from the field. So what do chimpanzees and bonobos do in the field? How does it relate to what we observe in captivity? You need to put the two pieces of the puzzle together to get a full picture. So, for example, we do experiments on cooperation. Now, cooperation is, we set up an apparatus on which two chimps have to pull to get their food and see how good they are to cooperate in that regard. But we need to connect that with what chimps do in the field. In the field, for example, chimpanzees cooperate to hunt monkeys. Monkeys are smaller than chimpanzees, and they live high up in the trees. They're very hard to catch, obviously. And so chimps need to cooperate. They need to surround them, and they need to have a task division to do that. And so we can compare what we find in captivity with what being observed in the field, and that gives us a sort of the complete picture.
So, you know, there are tests in which we have thought we found intelligence in a non-human animal. And I'm thinking particularly of, there was one African gray parrot who became the first non-human animal to ask an existential question. And that question was, what color am I? Does a test like that and a finding like that actually reveal intelligence on the part of that gray parrot?
Well, Alex the parrot is definitely very intelligent. Alex the parrot can count up things even. So they can show Alex, well, Alex died a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say that. But they could show Alex a few small items, like little pieces of pasta, for example, and put a cup over them. So you show him three pieces, you put a cup over it. You show him two more pieces, you put a cup over it. And then you say, how many pieces? And he says five. So he cannot even look at the pieces anymore because they're covered. But he has remembers them and he can count them up. And this was a capacity that everyone said cannot be done without language. And so that humans, there's always this thinking that humans solve all these problems with language. But actually, language is probably not nearly as important as we think in our thinking process. And Alex could do things that everyone had claimed, so categorization of things, like the existential question that you gave here. And he doesn't have language the way we have. Of course, he can label things, and that's why he can call out certain names and certain numbers. But he doesn't have language the way we do.
Language becomes a big point in your book as well, because there are animals who have learned to maybe mimic human sounds. Maybe they're not actually understanding language the way human language. I'm thinking of a gorilla learning sign language, for example, and how we compare that, if it's even possible or viable to compare that to, say, the language that another animal might use to warn of a predator coming or things like that. Mm-hmm. Can we compare the languages?
Well, the thing is that language is the one capacity in my whole book where I say that's probably special for humans. We've tried to teach it to animals, and we've tried to find it in their natural communication, but a symbolic system that is flexible like our language, I don't think we have found that. Now, that doesn't mean that animals don't have communication, and sometimes very complex communication. So, for example, chimpanzees and bonobos, they have facial expressions very similar to our facial expressions. They have hand gestures. But there are animals like, let's say, the killer whales and the dolphins that have underwater sounds that are very complex. And so the natural communication system of the animals is actually where we should be looking, I think, rather than trying to impose our communication, which is language, on them and see how far they get. I think it would be much, much more productive to look at what they can do naturally. And it's very complex what they do. So, for example, recently there was a study on alarm calls by chimpanzees, and they had put some artificial snake in the grass to see what they would do with it. And they found that the chimpanzees would only give the alarm calls to other chimps if the other chimps did not know about the snake. So they took into account what the others know or don't know about the snake, and that is called theory of mind. And that's another capacity that for the longest time we thought was uniquely human, but now it has been found in wild chimpanzees.
So what about, say, the language of prairie dogs, which, you know, this is a very simple animal, and I imagine most people don't think of prairie dogs as being particularly intelligent as compared to a dolphin, and yet their language is extremely specific.
Yeah, well, we usually wouldn't call it language. That's a sort of colloquialism, so we call it usually communication. And they have what we call referential communication, just like some monkeys do, where they have specific calls for specific predators. So they don't only communicate to each other, watch out, there's danger, but they also tell you what danger is out there. So it is actually quite complex. And we're discovering all these things in the last 25 years. We're discovering so many new things that we did not know about animals. And my book is partly about how it came about that we are discovering all these things now. And I think it is because in the previous century, we have simplified animals far too much. We tested them mostly in little boxes, you know, the so-called Skinner boxes for rats and pigeons. So we worked with small-brained animals in small boxes, and it is much more productive to set up complex experiments where they can show their full-blown potential, and that's what we're doing at the moment.
It also feels as though one of the things that has had to happen in order to move this research forward is for us our scientists to let go of sort of arrogant assumptions. And that brings me to the chimp Ayumu, to look at a chimp that is capable of much more than we are and think, well, maybe he is smarter if we're using a different scale.
Yeah. Yeah. So Ayumu can tap numbers on a touchscreen. From 1 to 9 or from 9 to 1. But the trick is, of course, the interesting part is that the numbers disappear within a few milliseconds. So you get barely, if you as a human look at the screen, you barely see the numbers and they disappear. And he has to tap the locations where the numbers used to be in the right order. And he does that. So he has a sort of flash memory that is better than human memory. As soon as this was found, people got very upset that this chimp was better than humans. And so some American scientists, they went into training to see if they could beat the chimpanzee. And they actually, they got quite far, but not far enough. And Ayumu keeps beating everyone. And I don't know why people are so upset about it, because that relates, of course, to the idea that we need to be on top with everything, every capacity. But there are so many capacities in the animal kingdom that we don't relate to at all. So, for example, a bat can catch prey in the dark, which it does with echolocation. We cannot do that. It takes an enormous amount of brain power to do this, to calculate the path of the prey and your own speed. And it's a very complex task, but we usually don't look at it because it doesn't relate to anything that we do. And so we think, well, that's probably an instinct or something. We try to downplay what the bat is doing, which is really remarkable. And this happens all the time. As soon as we are beaten by an animal, we try to beat it back, and we try to show that we are better. And if animals have capacities that are very different from ours, we sort of forget about it and we're not particularly interested in it.
So if in the past we have thought of intelligence as a ranking, kind of like the food chain where we're on the top, and if that's incorrect, then what's a better way of thinking of animal intelligence?
Well, instead of a tree or a ladder, what we have is a bush with many branches. That's the evolutionary bush, and many of these branches are specializations. And we have one specialization. We're very good at language and abstraction and technology. So we have several specializations, and then you have other animals. They have their specializations, and so each of these branches. So for example, you can find in the primate branch, you can find animals who use tools, such as ourselves or chimpanzees and so on. But you find them also in the crows. The crows are birds. It's quite a separate branch. branch from ours, but the crows are very good tool users, and they are being tested massively at the moment in laboratories. And so you have to look at it not as a ladder, like it goes from high to low. That's what people usually do. Who is the smartest of them all? And it has to be us, of course. But more like a bush with a lot of specializations.
So we have about a minute left. Can we answer the title of your book? Are we smart enough to know how smart animals are?
Well, I'm an optimist. I think we are smart enough for the task, and we are working very hard on it. But of course, the answer is that in the previous century, we didn't show that kind of intelligence. We tested animals in very simplistic ways, and we had very simplistic views about how they were instinctive or simple learners. We didn't really appreciate the intelligence of animals.
So the answer has been no, we weren't smart enough, but it's possible that we are.
Yeah, the new generation, I think, is, yeah.
Primatologist Frans de Waal. I spoke with him in May about his new book called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Georgia is home to almost 350 species of birds. That includes the cardinal, the mockingbird, and the brown thrasher. Each species has a unique voice, but it takes a really well-trained ear to tell them apart. Producer Sean Power spent a weekend in March with some local bird watchers to learn about the variety of chirps, tweets, and calls that can be heard throughout the state.
My name is Vinod Babu. I'm a postdoctoral researcher in Georgia Tech, and I'm one of the co-leaders of this walk today.
Hi, I'm Ralph Smith. I'm with the Atlanta Audubon Society, and I wanted to, you know, welcome along with Vinod, welcome you here this morning.
We have some robins on the line. We are actually hearing an eastern towhee sing now.
A lot of bird songs have, we make mnemonic sayings for them to help us remember their songs. And the one for the towhee is drink your tea. And it's drink your tea.
I'm with GPB, Georgia Public Broadcasting, the NPR affiliate. So question, did you know birds can sing?
No, I didn't know at all.
Really?
Yeah.
Does it sound like singing to you?
Yes, it really does. And it sounds beautiful, of course, because it's nature. My name is Ariana Tyson. I go to Georgia Cyber Academy, and I do dual enrollment at Gwinnett Technical College. Bird singing is their way of being themselves, because each type of bird has their own specific sound. And me, a lot of the times there aren't females that are into, you know, technology and the things that I'm into, and that's the way that I express myself. You know, I express myself with, you know, the coding that I do. And these birds, they express themselves with the way that they sing and the way that they fly.
Okay, so how many different birds are singing right now that we can hear? It feels like we're all around them.
I think I'm hearing five or so. That's the towhee, cardinal. I heard a song sparrow there, the brown-headed cowbird is singing, and the house finch.
Wow. My name is Sanji Henderson, internal auditor at Norfolk Southern.
Well, what do you think so far of what you've seen?
It's beautiful. It's hard for me to distinguish which birds are saying.
I know. I don't know how they're able to do it. I probably am tone deaf, but I don't know how they're able to tell like which song is which. I don't get it. It all sounds the same to me.
It doesn't sound the same, but it's hard to pinpoint.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. Where are we right now?
We're in the forest, in Fernbank Forest.
Okay.
And we can see some of the restoration work that's being done back there.
Where are we going to see the thrasher?
We might see one, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Cool. It was like 2,000 songs, I think.
Oh, yeah. It's the brown thrasher, which hopefully we'll see. It's one of the most prolific singers. It's got the widest repertoire of any bird in North America, and it's Georgia State bird.
Yeah. Well, I hope it can copyright some of those songs.
Well, no, it's actually mimicking other birds' songs, so if anything, the other birds should copyright it.
Or sue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sean Powers produced that segment on bird songs for us back in March. But consider this, is it accurate to describe sounds from animals as songs? We put that question to musicologist Jonathan Kramer. He teaches a class on bird songs at North Carolina State University.
Is music something that's species-specific to humans, or is music something that arises from nature? Is music based on the sound itself, or is music based on the intention of the sound producer or the intention of the listener? And that's sort of what this question hinges on. Are when birds are singing, are they doing the same thing that humans do when humans sing?
Now, I mean, Stravinsky had a lot of opinions on this. This has kind of been hotly debated in the music community, and he said that the sounds of nature are like music, but not music.
Correct. That's, he's famous for making that differentiation, because for Stravinsky, music is something that humans do, and when a human does makes music and communicates that musical intention to another human, that's what we mean by the word music, or at least that's what he means. When Oscar Hammerstein Jr. says, all the sounds of the world are like music, they're like music. We can listen to them as if they were music. We can enjoy them as if they were music, but they're not music. On the other hand, the sounds of the world, including bird song and I suppose frog song, although I can't think of an example, can become music in certain situations by any definition, like when the Finnish composer Ratavaro took a tape recorder up to Spitsbergen and recorded Migrating Swans, and then came back and wrote to his studio and wrote a concerto for birds and orchestra. Clearly the birds are music.
Let's take a listen, actually, Jonathan, to a little bit of that. This is from the Finnish composer Eino Juhani Rotavara. You know, Jonathan, that's not necessarily completely unique. We have Vaughan Williams wrote The Lark Ascending. You've got Respighi and the Birds. You've got Elgar, who wrote The Owls and tried to include owl calls as well. Does bird song then become song, real live musical song, when it's used by a classical composer?
Well, yes. Again, depending on how you define music. If music has to do with how we hear this, these sounds, and the intention of the human to use the sounds of birds as a musical instrument, in a sense, as in the example we just heard, then surely I think that's music. There are other examples around the world, like Afghani musicians who bring birds in cages to their concerts, and they start to play their rabobs, and the birds join in and sing with the rabob, and that's part of the performance. And that's clearly another example. In the case of Respighi, at the end of The Pines of Rome, the third movement, there's a little record that goes with the score. And when a symphony orchestra is going to play it, they get the record with the parts, the cello parts, the violin parts. And at the end of the third movement, you put the drop the needle. That was the technology in those days.
Yeah, I think it's on MP3 now.
And then you get the birds. And when I used to play with the North Carolina Symphony, we had a bass player named John Cubbage, I remember. And when we did the Pines of Rome, he could whistle it, so we didn't have to get the record. It was a big moment every year when the Pines of Rome were played. He got to do the whistling.
We've got about 30 seconds left, Jonathan Kramer.
Yeah.
Do you have a bird song that you particularly like?
I particularly like the little bird and played by the piccolo in Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf.
What?
Et cetera, et cetera.
Whoa, that is not easy to whistle.
No, it isn't.
Jonathan Kramer is a professor of music at North Carolina State University. Jonathan, thanks so much.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Like many of you, I am a proud pet owner. I have two very spoiled dogs, Simba and Samus. The two of them are inseparable. Here they are playing at my home in Marietta. I can't tell you how many times I wish I knew what they were saying to each other or to me. So what if dogs could talk with humans? Like this.
Excuse me. My owner needs your attention.
That was sound generated from a vest that can help service dogs communicate. It was developed as part of Georgia Tech's FIDO project. Melody Jackson leads that program, and she's the director of Georgia Tech's Center for Biointerface Research. Last year, I spoke with her and Greg Burns. He studies dog behavior at Emory University using an MRI machine. I had to ask him how he manages to keep the dogs still when he's testing them.
With lots of training and lots of treats.
Lots of treats. Well, treats always work. Well, let's talk a little bit about dogs. But Melody, I wanted to start off by kind of getting an overview of what this vest project is expected to do. It's not necessarily actually trying to interpret the thoughts of dogs.
That's correct, Celeste. The FIDO project, which stands for Facilitating Interactions for Dogs with Occupations, acronym actually, is about letting an assistance dog or any kind of a working dog give more clear information to their handler. And I'll tell you a quick story. If you have epilepsy and you have a medical alert dog, these dogs can detect seizures long before their owner knows that they're about to have a seizure. And what they usually do is they'll back the person up against a wall so that they don't fall down. And then when the person does have the seizure and is unconscious, they'll lick their face. But what if that dog could activate a sensor on their service dog vest that would actually call 911 and not just have the dog stay with the person, but literally summon help? It could be life-changing.
And this could be used in a lot of different ways, but the concept behind this is not that we're letting the dog speak, but that we have pre-chosen sentences or messages that the dog learns so that they can send that message in particular situations.
Correct. Another scenario is a hearing dog. So a hearing dog assists someone who is deaf, and they alert to sounds, and then they'll usually lead their owner to the source of the sound. So if the doorbell rings or someone calls your name, or the baby's crying, the dog will lead you to the source of that sound. But what if the sound is a tornado siren? The dog can't take you to the source of that sound, and they have no way of telling you what sound they just heard. So the FIDO vest would allow the dog to tell you what sound they just heard and hopefully make a much better decision about how to respond.
And interestingly enough, we're going to go to Greg in a moment in terms of what this all means about a dog's intelligence. But interestingly enough, Melody, there's all kinds of particular dogs. I was interested to read the part about dogs who are finding, say, a child who's lost. In the past, the dog would chase down the missing person, right, go find them, and then they'd have to run all the way back to get the rescue professionals and bring them to wherever that person was.
That's exactly right. That's called a recall and refind. So the person sends the dog out, the search and rescue officer, and the dog hopefully finds their target. But now, by now, they're a mile away from their handler oftentimes. The dogs are much faster than people. So the dog has to refind their handler and then refind the person that they were looking for. And this can waste valuable time. As well as we had a situation not too long ago where a young man who was on the autism spectrum was lost in the North Georgia mountains. And every time the dogs got nearby, he was afraid and he ran. So that meant they had to start the search all over again. If the dog could just activate a sensor on their vest, it would communicate to their handler, here I am, here's my GPS location, and I'm going to stay with this person. It could help immensely in the search process.
And what have we seen, Melody, in terms of training the dogs? How easy or difficult is it to get them to use these vests?
Well, we've trained probably about 12 different dogs to activate the sensors, and it's been remarkably easy. The longest it took for any of the dogs to learn any of the 9 sensors that we've created was 27 minutes, and the fastest time was 27 seconds.
Wow.
So the sensors are based on natural abilities of dogs, such as tugging and touching with the nose and holding and biting. So it's things that dogs typically do naturally.
So, Greg, that brings us to you, right? Because that makes it sound like that's incredibly fast. That's really smart. That's not, I guess, something that we generally associate with definitely my dogs, who seem to only have intelligence when it comes to stealing food. Are you surprised that the dogs are trained this easily?
No, I mean, Melody and I work together on some of these projects to link what she's doing with what we're doing in the MRI. And what Melody just described are indeed natural behaviors for dogs. So I'm not surprised that they're trained that quickly. Now, what we're doing with the MRI is not a natural behavior for any dog. It's not natural behavior.
Keeping them still,
humans.
You mean?
So we're training dogs to go in an MRI completely awake, unrestrained, unsedated, so that we can really try to decipher how their brains work and improve dog-human interactions, actually.
So, Melody, let me take this back to you. What kind of other opportunities does this open up in terms of a high level of social intelligence among dogs, many of whom are trainable because they're eager to please? What other opportunities are there, either with your vest or otherwise?
Well, that's a great question, and I have to totally agree with Greg that dogs are what you make of them. They have raw materials, but spending time with them is the key. And so one of the things we're looking at for pet dogs is something like a life alert type of, you know, my grandmother had a life alert type of necklace, but she didn't like to wear it because it was cumbersome and it wasn't pretty and she didn't like it. And so if she one time fell down in her kitchen and was stranded there for a couple hours until her neighbor heard her calling for help, but what if her little poodle could have been trained to touch some icons on a touchscreen that was mounted on the wall in the kitchen to summon help, to let me know she had fallen down, or to let the neighbor know that she had fallen down by sending a text message to her cell phone. So we are looking for more mainstream applications as well with this type of technology. We do have a touchscreen that dogs can activate, and it works quite well.
That was Melody Jackson of the Center for Biointerface Research at Georgia Tech and Greg Burns of the Center for Neuropolicy at Emory University. I spoke with them last year.